Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 711.mk1503, certificate number 25575, Lemmings.
One of these is a mousy little rodent called the lemming.
Lemmings from Motorhead? You ever, lemmings. As an Alaskan,
yeah.
You ever see lemmings? Are they just running around, just underfoot? They live in little holes in your home or your garage?
Lemmings? Well, there are no lemmings in Alaska.
Sure there are.
Lemmings?
There are 20 species of lemming, which are, they're rodents related to the vole. There's not like one lemming genus. There appear to be two different types of the true lemmings and the collared lemmings, which are the ones that turn white in the winter.
Are lemmings commonly thought of as Alaskan creatures? No.
I don't know how common it is to think of such. Well, apparently not by you, but they live there. I mean, there's 20 species and they span everything from Norway to Western Siberia to Eastern Siberia, Greenland, Canada, all the way over into Iceland.
But where are the lemmings that jump off the cliff?
Well, that's the interesting question. That's the one thing everybody knows about lemmings, right? They even made a video game out of it, that lemmings jump off cliffs.
Yeah, right. Lemmings jump off cliffs. It's the one thing lemmings do.
So you're saying even as Alaskan, you don't have this sense of lemmings as a creature that's out there the way you might think about the snowshoe hare or the ptarmigan?
No, we have voles in Alaska. In
congrats,
fact,
by the way.
Thank you. I used to catch them in bowls, voles in bowls.
You put bowls in bowls? Sorry, you put voles in bowls?
Yeah, we put voles in bowls.
Did you only do it for the rhyme, or is there another reason to put a vole in a bowl?
No, the first time I caught a vole, it was in a bowl just by happenstance, because there wasn't anything else to use to catch the vole.
And if you can't get it out, I mean, if it can't come out,
that's right.
It's a very slippery bowl.
Slippery-sided bowl. The vole couldn't get out. They're not like big hoppers. And then I loved the fact that it was a vole in a bowl. And so every subsequent, I mean, a vole just looks like a mouse. But a lemming, I didn't even know. I mean, are they like an Arctic thing?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So
they live in the north.
Yeah. So down in Anchorage, we never heard of lemmings. It was a north thing.
I thought you would just, out of Alaskan pride, you would know all your mammalian Alaskan species.
Well, I would have thought so too.
But I just realized now as I was trying to name some Alaskan species, I don't know what they are.
Oh, there are a lot.
There's moose and elk and caribou.
Mm-hmm. Musk ox.
Musk ox, yes. Alex Trebek loved the mighty musk ox.
Did he?
Yeah.
And why?
Maybe because he was Canadian? I don't know. Hmm. He would like, I think he saw something of himself in them.
Okay.
But he would also like donate to musk ox conservation causes. And,
right. There we had yaks and there were lots of little snow.
There are no yaks.
Creatures.
There are yaks. Maybe if they're domesticated. Was there a land bridge at some point during the Ice Age and the yaks all came over?
I feel like they're being raised in Alaska. Maybe they aren't native to Alaska, but there are a lot of yaks up there.
It's like seeing an emu on the Hood Canal. It's probably not from there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess that seems like a weird thing to do, but it seems also very Alaska that someone said, I'm going to put a bunch of yaks on a boat and take them to Alaska where they'll thrive.
Think of who that genius was. That's going to be an omnibus someday.
But there are brown bears, black bears, white bears.
All the bears, right.
Different kinds of bears. Lots and lots of bald eagles and ravens. who like to fight each other.
Eagles fight ravens?
Ravens fight eagles. Eagles just mind their own business.
Aren't the ravens smaller than the eagles?
Not by much. And what the ravens do is they gang up.
Oh.
So ravens are like, they bully the eagles. They don't like them. And they come at them. But the ravens in Alaska are like 4 feet tall. They're massive. Not 4 feet tall.
Yeah, ravens are like, if you think a raven is the size of a crow or a blackbird, you're going to be in for a surprise when you see a raven.
Yeah.
Because it's a whole different ballgame.
But then, of course, bald eagles in Alaska are also way bigger than normal bald eagles.
Than the ones here?
Yeah.
Just by virtue of being in Alaska, it gives them power and vitality?
Yeah. They're like really big.
I saw a picture of some bald eagle just flying around Mercer Street the other day, like day before yesterday. Like, there's enough breeding pairs of bald eagles now in Seattle parks that you can see them in pretty much any part of town.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Ravens are not as big as eagles, let's be honest, but they're big.
Eagles
are really big.
Real talk. Ravens, kids, I want you to know, ravens, not quite as big.
Just in case eagles. You thought I was saying that ravens and eagles were close in size.
Well, lemmings are both bigger and smaller than voles because they range. The very smallest lemmings are just a mere 3 inches long, but the biggest ones are about 9 inches. And they are cute. They're super cute. Voles just look like mice, which are kind of cute.
They're cute-ish.
But lemmings, because they're an Arctic species...
Don't they look like beavers or guinea pigs? They look like guinea pigs.
They look a little more like guinea pigs because the thing about living in the tundras of the north is that the magical, invisible hand of Charles Darwin has tried to maximize their calories by giving them the least possible surface area for their volume. Mm. And if you remember your geometry, that means a lemming is a sphere. And that's pretty much true. Yeah,
that's a little ball?
They don't have tails because that would be more body heat lost. They don't have long voley or moley snouts because that would be body heat lost. Mm-hmm. They are a cute little ball.
Aww.
And, you know.
Why don't I know about lemmings? What the heck?
I don't know. They're, they're social. Like, they get along well with each other in large groups. They're cute when they interact with humans. They can turn cranky if threatened. They can be territorial. So there is video of lemmings fighting with each other, or lemmings not enjoying the skier who is trying to take a video of them.
Lemming fight.
That's right.
Why did I think lemmings were Antarctic aminal?
There's not a lot of Antarctic mammals. Like, in fact, none, unless you count the aquatic ones, right? Seals and sea lions and
seals
walruses.
And sea lions, yeah. But I guess the way that penguins jump off of cliffs into the ocean, I just assumed that when lemmings went off a cliff,
they got the idea from the penguins. It's
just well,
peer pressure.
I feel
your penguin friends y'all jumped off a cliff, John, would you do it?
I feel like I only know about lemmings from Gary Larson cartoons.
Yeah, like let's trace through the pop culture the mystery of the lemming, because the main thing lemmings exist for is for this. This weird lore about their mass herding even unto death.
Yeah, God put them here just to be a metaphor for being a corporate.
For peer pressure?
Yeah, exactly.
God foresaw that there would soon be corporate bureaucracy. And he said, well, I don't have room for them nearby, but in the Arctic, I can put a species that would work for this.
Think about all the things that God does just to make metaphors possible. You know, like Godzilla movies.
Like a canary in a coal mine?
Yeah, as we talked about. Exactly. Why would you do that?
It's a metaphor.
Yeah, it's a metaphor.
The legend of...
Zelda.
The legend of Zelda has little or nothing to do with lemmings. But lemmings did have their own video game, right? Do you remember Lemmings?
No.
What's the era of Lemmings? Was it an arcade game? I think it was.
Where your goal was to jump off a cliff or to not jump off a cliff?
Puzzle strategy game, early 90s. Oh, no. It was like for personal computers. It was like originally desktop, like Amiga and ST lovers that could enjoy Lemmings. The Lemmings were trying to jump off a cliff, so you were trying to solve puzzles by, you know, providing or removing obstacles to get them where they wanted to go. It was like one of these water flowing games that phones had for a while, except with lemmings.
So the presumption was that lemmings were jumping off a cliff only because they wanted to go somewhere, but
Well, that's kind of the idea. Why else would you jump off a cliff?
Well,
you think they're just depressed?
I thought it lemmings was
lemmings are like, man, Norway sucks.
That one lemming was a dumbass and all the other ones followed him, kind of as a metaphor for
herd mentality.
Yeah.
But the first one must have wanted to go over that cliff.
Well, because it was a dumbass.
Right. I always forget. Do you think asses are another thing that God put on earth to be a metaphor?
Oh, asses.
I meant donkeys, not butts.
Oh, I see. Huh.
God could have created butts for many reasons.
Donkeys are actually featured in a lot of metaphors, aren't they?
Yes, their stubbornness.
Yeah.
Their, and Winnie the Pooh, their sadness.
Right.
But we use ass to mean, smartness. We use ass to mean stupid, even though donkeys are not a famously stupid. If anything, they're kind of out-punching their weight brains-wise.
Wait a minute, you're blowing my mind. When we say dumbass, we're just talking about a donkey, not a butt?
Yeah, I think that's the source for all ass talk, is that it used to be a donkey.
Oh, what? An ass used to be a donkey?
Well, it still is.
Okay.
I'm not saying people didn't have butts.
Right. But
because back then, no one had a butt. Your legs went right into your stomach.
But why would a butt be dumb? Now I get it. It wouldn't. A butt isn't smart.
Although now that you say this, I don't know when arse made the switch from a barnyard animal to a body part. I'm not sure.
Boy, this is a lot to take in.
I think maybe we should just stop talking about lemmings and start talking about asses.
Uh-huh. That sounds like one of my other podcasts.
Do you think it's a parallel thing where it sounds like anus? So it
anus means dumb?
No, so it means butt first.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
I just don't know how it means both donkey and butt, and I had never actually considered this.
Have you thought about how big a donkey's butt is? A donkey is like 50% butt.
Do you think donkeys are the most butt-heavy animal?
I mean, a horse has got a big butt.
And I cannot lie.
What are the other animals that have big butts?
Like maybe a bear?
Bear is big in the butt area, but I wouldn't describe it as...
We always say haunches for animals. We try to be nice.
Yeah.
We're like, oh, look at those big haunches.
The thing about a bear butt is a bear is shaped like a pear or a shmoo.
Yeah, big butt.
If you shaved
a person shaped like a pear, you'd be like, big butt.
Yeah. If you shaved a bear, it'd look like a shmoo.
Is that true? Wouldn't have any arms and legs?
I don't know. I've never shaved a bear.
Your arms and legs are only fur. It's like that Looney Tunes alien.
I'm going to destroy the earth with my particle accelerator.
I meant the big hairy one.
Oh, right.
I think it's in the same cartoon, though. Isn't that a Marvin the Martian cartoon?
Yeah, it's Marvin's pet.
Yes, that's right. So the lore about the weird thing about lemming behavior appears to date back to European legends of... maybe like the 1500s.
Whoa.
Maybe there's oral medieval legends here, but it appears to be early naturalists kind of Pliny the Elder-wise trying to solve the mystery of lemmings. And the mystery appears to be that they are, relative to other species that Europeans would have been familiar with, they have wildly varying population changes.
Oh.
Like lemmings peak.
I see.
There are lemming peaks.
Why are there more lemmings this year?
Right.
You know, why is today different from all other days?
Because there's a lot of lemmings.
Why are there more lemmings this year than last year? Something must have happened to them.
Yes. And so legends begin to grow because of the dispersal. And this is actually just because of how lemming reproduction works. It's a species that produces a ton because there's also a lot of fallow years. Lemmings of the north need, I think, snow as insulation. Even though we think of snow as cold, a lemming thinks of snow as a way to keep warm. So they will only reproduce in summers when there was a nice snowy winter. Huh. So following a snowy winter, you get a lemming peak and you get a ton of lemmings, and they will disperse. You know, they're not migratory like birds, but they will, you know, their herds will take off trying to find new sources of food, whatever roots and seeds they're into.
And I'm guessing, based on what I do know about the North, that everything wants to eat a lemming.
Yes, they're an important part of the food chain. They're a little delicious animal that foxes and owls and hawks and all the rest love to eat.
Right.
But Norwegians could not figure this out. You and I, would see a population coming and going and think, they good reproduction conditions this year.
But the Norwegians are like, ooh, voo, voo.
A Norwegian of the 16th century comes up with theories like, there's a lot of lemmings this year because they all fell from the sky like rain.
Oh, Norwegians.
Or,
what a quaint people.
There's fewer lemmings than last summer because they all exploded.
Oh, yeah.
So Norwegian theories about lemmings include that they fall from the sky like rain, okay, or that they explode.
Norwegian theories about lemmings is a great song title and a great, I mean, it's, I love it.
What is it? It's a built to spill song, yeah. Or, now,
Lissavifob.
But how did this all come to us with this assumption that no, there's a different explanation for the rising and falling of lemming populations?
Oh, wait, I was just mocking how dumb the Norwegians were, but then we just followed up with the stupid theory.
I mean, ours is a little better. Like, which is more likely, a lemming exploding like a firecracker or a lemming jumping off a cliff?
Oh, but wait, what you were saying is our dumb theory is derived from the dumb Norwegian theory.
Yes. Like, there's a long history of people seeing these wild swings in lemmings populations and saying, this must be the species that, and then explaining it away.
Right. Got it.
But to understand why we think that lemmings all rush into the sea, as apparently we all do, we have to go back to the early days of film. And I guess we've been doing a lot of movie omnibuses lately.
We love the movies on Omnibus.
You did North Korean movies last week.
Right.
And then when it was Oscar and Grammy time, I did a couple movie shows.
I know. Well, you love movies more than I love movies. I think we
I love movies
we know
more
that.
Than I love anything.
Yeah.
I mean, there's other things I love. I love quesadillas.
Have you?
But I don't have a quesadilla a day, and I watch it. And I watch a movie a day. Yeah, they're really good.
Of all the Mexican cuisines, quesadillas are the one you single out?
I could have said tacos, but quesadillas are good. It's a funnier name.
Aren't quesadillas just some sort of Tex-Mex invention? They're not even something that's in Mexico?
I don't know. I'm gonna blow your mind about every other Mexican dish we eat. It's probably the same. Like, you go to some actual, you're in this great state of Guerrero and they're like, what's a tostada? Get out of here.
Have you ever watched four movies in a day? Four movies in one day.
That's a great question. It seems like the kind of thing I would have done in college with a plan.
Right.
But I can't think if it ever would have been four.
Like, you're going to watch all of the Godfather movies plus, plus one Marvel movie.
Plus Goodfellas.
Oh, yeah, that all checks out.
I don't know if I've ever seen four movies in it. Do you have a four-movie day in your past?
No way.
Oh, you picked such an exact number, I thought you were about to have a story.
No, no. I was just recalling the North Korea episode where Kim Jong-il made his kidnapped South Korean film stars watch four movies in a day, and I was like,
it did sound pretty good. I was movies. Like, if I wish I had that kind of time. What I need to do is move somewhere, I'll get kidnapped by North Korea.
That's the thing.
And then they'll just stream movies for me in their human zoo.
The only way you could say, yeah, I've seen four movies in a day, is if somebody forced you. And you'd be like, oh, I had to watch 8 hours of movies.
For me, it would have to be a project. Like, don't you remember that weekend we thought it would be funny to watch every Wes Anderson movie? Yeah.
How many movies would that be? Like,
it's up to
eight movies.
No, it's up to 10 or 11. Should we take a second to name Wes Anderson movies, or would that just be even more boring than what we're already doing?
Steve Zissou.
There we go. You have control of the board. Bottle Rocket, Rushmore, Royal Tenenbaums, Life Aquatic. I think those might be the first four. Darjeeling Limited. Then there's Fantastic Mr. Fox. Then later he made that other stop-motion movie, Isle of Dogs. We're up to seven.
I never saw Isle of Dogs.
Then there's...
which is the one set in the old
Grand
Hotel.
Grand Budapest Hotel. French Dispatch. That's nine. I think I forgot one between Fantastic Mr. Fox and Grand... oh, Moonrise Kingdom. That's
Moonrise
10.
Moonrise Kingdom.
He's got another one coming up in a few months with a weird European name. Is it 10 or did I forget one? Let us know. Let us know which one we forgot.
Let us know in the comments. Like and subscribe.
We're going to go back to the early days of documentaries, or as they were called before the word documentary had been coined, actuality films.
Is that right? I have never heard that term.
You think we could bring that back?
Actuality films.
I'm just going to, instead of watching a doc, I'm going to watch an act. Instead of a mockumentary, it's a mockuality.
Can you maybe briefly differentiate, if we were going to keep both terms, what is an actuality film in contrast to a documentary?
I would say a documentary has to have documents in it. It has to be one of those.
Okay.
Maybe
or document something.
It's one of those weird, maybe Christian movies that shows in theater as a Fathom event. Because it's about, like, we found Noah's Ark.
Oh, yeah.
Or kids on college campuses are too woke.
Right.
Those should have their own name. Documentaries.
Those are documentaries?
Well, I don't know. You think they should have the, you don't think they should have the good name? I think Actuality Films is such a great name. I want to reclaim that for long found footage things.
Yeah. Actumentaries.
That sounds like it has action, which it could.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, as a moment's thought, if you think of the earliest movies you can think of, they were all actuality films, you know, these 9-second movies.
Birth of a Nation?
No, movies without the Klan. Like even further back, like Thomas Edison movies of a dude sneezing.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Or French movies of, men and women walk into a factory.
Yeah. Or horses.
A horse runs, a train pulls into a station. In the early days of film, because of both the newness of the medium and the length of these films, there was no narrative, no characters, no nothing.
Right.
You were just, it was enough to watch things move brightly in a dark room.
Right.
Which is really, to me, most of the reason I go to the movies.
Yeah, still.
If things are moving brightly in a dark room and I have popcorn, I don't really care if it's a good movie.
See, I think that's the difference between you and me.
I think that's the difference between me and America now. Nobody wants to go to the movies.
Is that right? Oh, yeah, I guess the last few movies I've been to, I'm like, where is everybody?
You don't go to the movies enough to notice this. The funny thing is, if you go to the movies in L.A., a company town, it is still lively. You'll go to some kind of fourth-tier movie on a Tuesday, and you'll realize, oh, why didn't I buy tickets earlier? This place is full, and it's all high schoolers. Like everybody goes to the movies in L.A.
That's crazy.
And here, I went to the Captain America movie on a Friday night after it came out, and
nobody cared.
Yeah, three other couples, some asleep. It looked like maybe many had been there since the last screening ended. Dystopian times for moviegoers.
Do your kids not go to the movies anymore?
We try to encourage it, but no. I think we're going to try to see Paddington this weekend with my younger kid.
The bear?
No, the train station. It's going to be a movie of a train pulling into a station, and we're all going to be scared. Yeah, the bear. He has big screen adventures now.
Well, but am I right that Paddington is like kind of for adults too? Like Paddington's got snarky comments and stuff?
Well, he doesn't, but like there's always a villain. Nicole Kidman or Hugh Grant plays a villain, a campy villain that adults or gays can enjoy.
That's smart.
It's got the Paddington 2 had like 100% Rotten Tomatoes rating. It was like the best reviewed movie in the history of the internet. Because it's a fun, well put together family thing that works for all ages.
It's a bear that dresses, he has a hat.
It's a bear that has a hat. The main thing you have to understand, because you're from Alaska where bears don't have hats. So you're like,
right.
This is bullshit. I'm not going to this movie. This bear has a hat.
What the hell? All right. Okay.
He's also from Peru.
What? Paddington Bear is from Peru?
You didn't know that he was are you worried that he's a DEI bear?
Doesn't he have a British accent?
Well, he comes to Britain from Peru.
Does at any point in the film he have a Peruvian accent?
It's before Brexit. Well, in this third movie, he's going to go back to his Peruvian roots. No, he does not. Wouldn't that be funny if Paddy had a Peruvian accent? No, he shows up speaking fluent the Queen's English.
Okay. All right.
Anyway, back to Silent Era when they didn't know about Paddington yet. All movies were actuality films. So you didn't, there wasn't this distinction today that, well, a documentary is something boring. And a lot of the big draws, the new developments in film were documentary films. Like people would love to go to a sports film and watch highlights from a boxing match.
Or they love documentaries. Why are you disparaging them?
I feel like everybody loves documentaries.
Well, yeah, right.
Not really. A small number of devoted people like documentaries. They do not tend to out-earn Sonic the Hedgehog movies.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, okay.
They're a niche thing. But they were mass entertainment back in the day. You would go to watch a surgery or a boxing match on the movie screen. Or
like an actuality filmed a boxing match or a scripted one.
Yeah, instead of going to the trouble to make a script and a fictional adventure, it was just easier to bring your camera to something interesting, an autopsy, for example, or a trip to the lake. So a lot of these were travelogues, you know, like
Lake.
No, it really was. It was like, look, we can see movies of faraway Paris. You know, that was a novel thing that was worth going to.
We talked about the first porn movie was just a movie about somebody watching somebody else go pee.
Right. That's an early actuality film until the girls are like, say. The early travelogues were called scenics, by the way. Mm-hmm. You want to go see a scenic?
The early travel films were called scenics. All right.
The word documentary did not get coined until the 1920s for the first big documentary hit, which was, do you know this? Have you ever seen Robert Flaherty's Nanook of the North?
Oh, sure. Yeah, Nanook of the North was a big deal.
Does every Alaskan school child have to watch Nanook of the North?
Not anymore, but we all watched it because at the time our knowledge of the indigenous peoples of our own state was kind of influenced by this 1920s movie. Like, oh, apparently that's what's going on up there.
Yeah, actual Inuits have spent decades trying to explain that Nanook of the North is not a very good actuality film.
Right.
But as usual, the colonizing people were not paying a lot of attention to this.
No, that's true. Up until very recently.
Nanook was made in northern Quebec, so it's not going to be, you know, the very close relatives of Alaskan natives, but, you know, the same peoples.
Yeah.
Robert Flaherty was actually not a documentarian.
Hmm.
He was like a mineral prospector. He was just an adventurer who liked to go up to the north.
Love it.
And movie cameras being a new technology, he thought, nobody's got footage of this. So he took a three-week, he went to Rochester, New York, and took a three-week course in from Eastman Kodak in how to run one of these cameras.
Love it.
And he headed back up north to hang out with the native peoples and to see the amazing scenery while he's doing his, whatever his gold hunting thing is. And he gets really good stuff. He loves the footage. He sits down to think, how can I edit this into a movie? Unfortunately, two facts of the period were that everybody smoked and film was still made of nitrate.
Oh, no.
And so
somebody burned up the negatives?
He burned up his own negative.
What a ding dong.
His own cigarette habit led to his amazing footage of the North becoming a conflagration. So he's a guy who has this idea of a great movie he can put out. And more to the point, he kind of knows what kind of things he wants to happen. So if he ever was a strict actuality films purist, he is not anymore because he wants to go back to the North and recreate the stuff he got.
This sounds like the time that Love and Rockets, there was a fire in the studio and it burned up their masters.
Oh, no.
And they had to go back in and record the album over again, having already made the album.
What's the result? Is it,
I think it was
beautifully perfect, or is it an airless nightmare?
No, it was a pretty good record because they were like, you know, it took us weeks and weeks to think all that stuff up. Now we just go in and do it.
Well, he makes a good movie. It takes him 4 years to get funding to go back. He doesn't get back to the North until 1920 or 1921.
Are the people still there?
They are, but he's doing the thing in Groundhog Day where he's trying to like make all the good stuff happen again.
Oh.
So it's no longer, if it ever was, a real snapshot of native life. I mean, down to the very basic things. Have you seen the movie, right?
Yeah.
It's great. It still holds up.
It's
unfortunately
totally great. The stars are very captivating.
They are. Unfortunately, there is no Nanook. That guy's name is Alaka Rialak. Flaherty just thought Nanook, meaning polar bear, was a cooler name.
It's a pretty cool name.
And so, and this is the kind of ethic that rules his decision making. He wants Nanook to have a cute wife, but the woman in the movie is not his wife. It appears to just be maybe a native girl that Flaherty was sleeping with, one of several.
Mm-hmm.
The real Alaka Rialak liked to hunt with a gun. He was no dummy.
Right.
But Flaherty is like, no, Eskimos hunt with spears and harpoons, dummy. So he makes him leave behind his like actual lifestyle and technology, the better to look like a white person's idea of an Eskimo hunting. There's funny comedy scenes that happen in the movie, like, you know, Nanook goes to a trading post and can't believe this gramophone is making noise.
Yeah, he puts his ear by it.
He tries to bite the record. In fact, the real Alaka Rialik like owned a gramophone. You know, like right. none of this stuff is real.
Had a snowmobile.
he had a snowcat. There's a scene in the and the guy had big Flaherty had big cameras that could not shoot interior scenes. Really, there was not enough light.
Dark, yeah.
So everything that happens in an igloo is fake. He tried to make Alaka Rialik build a 25-foot igloo that would be big enough to put the camera in.
And, that's a lot of work. The roof won't support.
That's what happens. Right. Like they do this multiple times and the roof keeps collapsing. And the actors are all cracking up like, this guy trying to make us build this impossible igloo, you know? Finally, I think they just built a half igloo and faked all the interior scenes. But audiences didn't know. Audiences thought they were getting this amazing anthropological snapshot of the North. And I'm sure, you know, as we've discussed, all anthropologists shape their subjects in this way.
Yeah.
But rarely so nakedly as Flaherty.
Well, and the subjects of anthropology research are also probably always laughing and going like, hey, guess what we're doing today?
This dude says we have to pretend we don't know what a gramophone is. We have to make a 25-foot igloo. You can't make a 25-foot igloo. The success of Nanuka the North is actually what led... I think another Canadian film critic to invent the word documentary.
Really?
For this kind of, at the time, I think it was a goofy sounding portmanteau of the kind that Time Magazine would invent. Oh, it's a document, but it's also a movie. Documentary. And now we don't even think of it. We think of it as a very scholarly, fusty sounding term of art.
Right.
But somebody who loved Nanuka of the North, because he actually loved the North and Alaska in general, was Walt Disney.
Yes, the hero of so many stories.
He was, he had a background in actuality films when he was just an early, even before he was a big time animation name, when he was just trying to start up a movie studio.
He caught that movie about the mouse piloting that boat. That was pretty cool.
Which one? Ratatouille?
The one with the mouse in the boat. Yeah.
Yeah, the documentary about...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
That was pretty amazing. I didn't know that mice could do that.
Before Mickey Mouse was created, he actually paid the bills making educational shorts for dentists.
I didn't know that.
I didn't either. But I guess, you know, well into Disney being a name, dentists were still showing his 1920-something Clara Loses a Tooth. Or something like that.
So they had actual people in them, not...
Right.
I see.
Right. They were humans. And during World War, you know, so he makes his name in animation, but during World War II, the studio pivoted to making movies to support the war effort, many of which were live action, all of which were cheaper and easier to make than his very cost-intensive animated movies, a lot of which had started to lose money when he lost foreign audiences to the war.
Oh right, they were big in Germany until Chaplin made fun of Hitler.
Yeah, Hitler and Mussolini all banned Mickey Mouse, I think, for being a good patriotic American mouse.
Right.
We'll get back to the other rodents. Don't worry. So after the war, you know, to survive, he now had all these live action crews that had been making World War II movies, and Disney thought, well, we need to start putting out.
Actuality films.
Yeah, cost-effective actuality films, not like these big bloated animated movies that sometimes lose us a ton of money, because Fantasia lost money. I think Pinocchio had just because of the war. And also, the other thing we know about Disney, if you've ever been to his namesake land, that dude loved The Vanishing Frontier.
He did.
It was his main thing. He thought kids, he was not wrong, kids in the 50s just wanted to go into a fake cavalry fort. That was the main thing kids wanted.
So the only thing I cared about.
A fake cavalry fort, all the customer surveys said. So Disney had spent some time in Alaska, you know, with one of these kind of puddle jumping pilots, hopping from lake to lake, seeing cool stuff. I think at one point almost dying, you know, he was taking risks out there.
That's how Will Rogers died.
It's true. It's true. He brought his daughter Sharon, though, so maybe he shouldn't have been.
I didn't know there was a Sharon Disney. Did she end up doing something, inheriting Disney or anything?
There were two or three Disney daughters, some of whom are any of them still alive, or are they grand? Maybe they may be granddaughters now. Anyway, at one point he walks into this general store somewhere in the middle of nowhere, Alaska, And it turns out this store is owned by two Michiganders named the Milots.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're now in the late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And the Milots have, I think one of them went to UW actually and mm-hmm. spent some time in Alaska before going back to work. They had been photographers in Chicago and adventurers in Alaska. And when they tell Disney this, he's delighted. He says, look, I'm going to send you cameras. I'm going to send you film. I want footage of the North. Because he's got Nanook of the North in his mind, that you can make a hit movie just by observing the marvels of Alaska.
Right.
He's like, I want it all. I want miners. I want bears. I want natives and igloos and sleds. I want pipelines. I want everything. And so they just start shooting film. They just shoot thousands and thousands of feet of film, and they send it to Walt in Burbank, and he hates it.
Yeah, where's the jokes?
It's boring. Like this. Yeah, this is Mr. Executive Notes, yeah. And he's watching coal miners.
Yeah, miners have all Ketchikan seen record players.
Yeah, and but there's one part of the movie that works. They've taken some film of seals.
Okay.
Maybe out on the Pribilof Islands, I think. Do you know where that is? Yes, I don't. I do. Bering Sea, maybe. So they've got some film of seals. And Walt is delighted.
Like, yeah, they're fun.
Like, this is actual good stuff. And so he says, I'm going to send you more films. Please, no more miners. I think we can make a movie about seals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a point... This is the phone call that basically creates the nature documentary, because I've mentioned sports movies, science movies, scenic travelogues, trains pulling into stations. Nobody has thought
things in nature are cool.
That there's a market for there. You know, there were, you know, these some amateur Thomas Edison era photographers who were taking movies of wildlife, but there was no audience for this thing. But the Milots shoot more footage on the Pribilofs. Disney Studios assembles a 27-minute movie called Seal Island.
This is like proto David Attenborough.
Exactly. There is no, you can't watch a National Geographic Jacques Cousteau style thing. Disney's inventing it from the whole cloth. And in fact, he coins a name for it. He's like, these are our true life adventures because they're true to life. Get it?
Now, when I was a kid and we all crowded around the television for the Wonderful World of Disney, like specials.
Yeah, Sunday night.
Were the ones that we were watching leftovers from, or like from these olden days? Because I remember all of these like movies where a bunch of seals just do seal things.
Disney ended up making about 13 or 14 of these, as we will see. Full length, or you know, of varying lengths from short subject to full length. And then these would be recut into smaller things that, you know, the school classrooms could show on 16mm.
Yep.
They could be chopped up for his TV show. So he's, you know, he had a documentary arm that was still making nature documentaries, so you could have been seeing new stuff. But yeah, probably you were seeing repackaged material from the 50s and 60s.
That's what being Generation X was. I don't know if you know this, but Generation X is being completely erased now.
Oh,
and
no.
So we can go back to being... neglected and quiet and unimportant.
But it turns out we were just watching warmed over boomer media anyway.
Right. That's right. Our tweets are all boomer.
They're just jokes about Jerry Colonna.
They're all okay boomer stuff where it's like, yeah, that's hilarious. People being drunk.
We had a bunch of, we had a bunch of boomer media and Knight Rider. And yep. that's our entire cultural background.
Oh, no.
I have a TV theme song that I cannot place. And the other night it came to me and I sang it into my phone.
And your phone recognized it?
No, although I think Google will do that. I should probably figure out how to do that. But I just have a record now. And sometime when I have a second free, I'm going to solve this mystery.
Why don't you just play it right now and we'll hear...
Some user will tell me. Yeah. Some listener will tell me. If I could find my voice memos app, I would absolutely do this. Okay, if I put this phone too close to the mic, it might buzz, but it's a TV show whose theme sounds like this. Bum, bum. For a while, I thought it was Dallas, but it's not Dallas.
Isn't that like Sports Center or something?
It could be the Big Valley. It could be the Scarecrow and Mrs. King. I have no idea.
Scarecrow and Mrs. King. Wow. Who knows? Okay. All right.
Anyway, why were we talking about? Oh, right. So Disney has this 27-minute movie about seals, mm-hmm. doing seal things, mm-hmm. with a narrator kind of joking about them. And RKO is Disney's distributor, and they won't release it. They say there's no market for a 27-minute movie about seals. And they're right. Nobody's ever tried to sell or show just a nature movie before.
But wasn't this at a time when every movie was a double feature and the first feature was always something?
Yeah, like that's why Disney had this short subject swing to make cartoons that would show in front of the main feature.
Right.
It was a huge audience. But RKO, and it's also a little longer than most short subjects. It's 27 minutes. Disney has a friend in Pasadena who runs a movie theater, and he says, hey, can you exhibit this for one weekend so it can be up for the Oscar? Because Disney has this idea that, you know,
that there's an actuality film Oscar.
Yeah, well, there is. There's a short subject Oscar, and 27 minutes is long to submit to that. But he thinks, you know, this is like a high-minded, educational, first-of-its-kind thing. This has a chance.
Right.
So they show it in Pasadena for a weekend. Sure enough, it gets nominated for the Oscar. Sure enough, it wins. On a budget of, I mean, it costs quite a bit of money because he's, you know, he's sending cameras and equipment up to the Arctic Circle. But on a budget of $80,000, this movie makes $434,000.
Okay.
It's a huge hit.
Just playing in Pasadena alone?
No. After the Oscars, I think Walt tells Roy, hey, take this Oscar over to RKO and hit him over the head with it.
Yeah, that's the spirit.
So, you know, it becomes a short subject in theaters before Disney movies. RKO agrees to distribute it. It's not the first wildlife documentary, but there's now a theatrical market for this.
What was the first wildlife documentary?
You know, it was just somebody taking a picture of a monkey in a zoo or horses running around or something. You know, I'm not saying nobody had ever pointed a camera at a tree or a lion.
I see what you're saying.
But suddenly, this is an art form. And Walt just insisted as part of the marketing campaign around these true life adventures that you were seeing the real thing. Uh-huh. You know, no monkeying with nature, no humorous anthropomorphic indulgings, either in context or treatment. Mickey and Donald take care of that in our regular family department. Ha ha ha, you know.
But how could you monkey with what a seal is doing? A seal's going to seal.
He said, seals are nature's best actors. There's nothing you can do to improve on it. And it's kind of true that, you know, there's an arc in the movie of a pup who gets lost from his parents on the beach and has to find them.
Oh, it's the narrative arc that's kind of ginned up.
And in fact, it is ginned up a little. Like when you watch that baby seal in Seal Island try to find its parents. In fact, you're watching a series of different seals who, luckily for nature documentarians, all look alike.
Yeah, right.
Because it's a common thing in these massive seal crowds for a baby to wander off.
You're like,
right. Arr. So you're watching a ton of different baby seals reenact this arc. And in fact, Winston Hibbler, the Disney story man and camera operator, kind of jack of all trades, who became a Winston Hibbler. There used to be people named Winston Hibbler.
That's awesome.
We used to be a proper country. He became the narrator of a lot of these true life adventures, just from maybe from being the temp track script guy and then kind of easing his way into it. And he admitted that in most of these cases, they would write the narration first.
Right.
And then
find the footage.
And then find the footage that would make it work.
I mean, I have for sure watched nature documentaries where a seal pup is going erp, erp, and trying to find its mom. And for the middle of the film, we're like, well, it's not going to find its mom. Do you think I was watching this very one, or did that plot become the number one plot for nature documentaries for a few years?
I bet there's multiple seal movies that have a lost pup. But that said, you could have been watching Seal Island. It's an Oscar winner.
Right, exactly.
Disney won 8 more Oscars for this series, which ran up until, I think, 1960 or so.
These feel like Grammys for best packaging.
Exactly. I mean, because the movie is either up for full-length documentary or short subject, you know, not the most competitive fields
right.
in the 50s. So he's, you know, it's not like he's beating Ben-Hur to win these Oscars.
He's filling shelves is what he's doing.
But I think one of these, the one we're about to talk about, 1958's White Wilderness, it's the penultimate true life adventure.
Racist.
It was actually, no, it's just the snow. It was actually up for 2 Oscars. It was nominated for Best Documentary Feature and for its musical score.
Oh.
You know, these were prestigious movies that Disney spent some money on.
A musical score that was in competition with dramatic films that had a music score?
Yeah, exactly.
Whoa.
The 1958 Oscars. Well, let's see. We can find out. I don't think it won. White Wilderness Best Score. Oscars 1958. It won the Best Documentary Feature Oscar. You know how hard it is to look up Oscars because, you know, the 1958 movies are awarded in 1959.
Oh.
So they number them. What I need is the 31st Academy Awards, apparently.
There were already 31 Academy Awards by 1958?
Eight.
Huh.
Yes. In the spring of 1959, the movie's up for Best Musical Score of a Dramatic or Comedy Picture.
Okay.
Because musicals were still their own category, won by Gigi that year. These are not great. The Big Country, William Wyler's Western The Big Country with Gregory Peck and Charlton Heston is pretty good. Separate Tables with David Niven, Omnibus Favorite David Niven, we like. The Young Lions. Oh, it's that Marlon Brando, Montgomery Clifty. Have you seen this? That World War II movie?
The Young Lions, yeah.
Tiomkin wins for The Old Man and the Sea. And then White Wilderness, Disney music guy Oliver Wallace. Crazy. Anyway, so this was a time when Disney had such hits with these that he was winning awards hand over fist. They were competing with the biggest fiction films in Hollywood for awards. People looked forward to, you know, Disney to tell them about The Vanishing Prairie or The Living Desert.
Right.
And in 1958, he returns to Canada for White Wilderness, and Walt Disney personally loved Canada. Canada often claims Disney as Canadian in the way they will always do if anybody has even a tenuous grasp at Canadian residency or ancestry.
What did he do beyond go up there to make movies?
His dad's family had come from Canada, and in fact, due to a loophole in some kind of residency or immigration law at that time, his dad was actually, I think, a Canadian citizen.
Oh.
So it's not as distant as it seems.
Mm-hmm.
But Disney returns to Canada to make a movie called White Wilderness, which has scenes about, you know, walruses and polar bears and all that you'd expect. But crucially for our story, it follows the tiny lemming. Now, the narrator at the outset of this movie, of the lemming scene, says, it is said of this, this is Winston Hibbler, it is said of this tiny animal that it commits mass suicide by rushing into the sea in droves. So this was a legend that existed in 58, handed down from these European stories of, hey, where do these mass migrations of lemmings come from? The story is one of the persistent tales of the Arctic. And as often happens in man's nature lore, it is a story both true and false, as we shall see in a moment.
Huh.
And the narrator goes on to explain that, you know, they're not committing mass suicide. They just are trying to cross a river and they don't know that the river is the ocean. You know, they're driven by this imperative to migrate. And sometimes they don't know it's an inconveniently large body of water.
Really?
The narrator really does, after kind of debunking this, the narrator really does speak of it as kind of a death urge. A kind of compulsion seizes each tiny rodent, and carried along by an unreasoning hysteria, each falls into step for a march that will take them to a strange destiny.
A hysteria?
An unreasoning hysteria, a compulsion. That destiny is to jump into the ocean. They've become victims of an obsession, a one-track thought. Move on, move on. This is the last chance to turn back, yet over they go, casting themselves out bodily into space. And so is acted out the legend of mass suicide.
I want to remake this movie with you narrating it.
It's pretty good. You were on the edge of your seat, I could
tell. I was.
You were leaning forward.
I was like, what is going to happen
your
next?
Your ears were, and you couldn't even see the video. Because in the movie, this is accompanied by video of these lemmings enacting their death march.
So is it in slow motion or is it in real time?
It's in real time. And even though Hibbler has just said, well, you know, it's not really a mass suicide, the narration then goes on to actually absolutely emphasize the point that some kind of weird compulsion is driving these animals into the sea. What mysteries nature is full of.
I almost certainly have seen this. It feels like this is what we watched in the 1970s.
A generation or two grew up watching lemmings do this, thanks to Walt Disney,
right,
and becoming convinced that there was truth to this legend.
Yeah.
That the main thing we know about, which he kind of refers to as an Arctic legend, now kind of enters the mainstream culture at every latitude.
Because it does, in my imagination, it does feel like I thought of it as a compulsion, like a madness.
Seizes the lemmings.
A hysteria of, like, in rodents.
So here's what actually happened. Disney persuaded, it's unclear whether Walt knew, but despite all his protestations about how accurate and unvarnished the True Life Adventures were, in this case, there was a couple problems with the lemmings scene. For one thing, Disney had gone to Alberta and Manitoba to shoot this movie. The lemming scenes were shot in Alberta. Alberta, number one, has no lemmings.
Hmm.
Number two, famously landlocked.
Right.
Very hard to photograph lemmings jumping into the sea
from Alberta.
What they had done, Disney had obtained some lemmings in Manitoba, where they're also not native. I think the story that's most often told is they had gone to Inuit kids who had pet lemmings and said, "Hey, kid, want to sell a lemming?"
But wait, aren't there like 1,000 lemmings jumping off the cliff, or did they just have the same 7 lemmings that were like...
They have a few dozen cleverly shot, you know, they're using all of Eisenstein's tricks to make you think, you know, they're using Soviet propaganda techniques to make you think you're seeing a bunch of lemmings dead set on jumping into the ocean, when in fact there are few lemmings, no compulsion, and no ocean.
Wow, okay.
They go to the Bow River in Alberta for the shots of the lemmings plummeting over the edge. For the shots of the lemmings running, it's very hard to make, the 20 pet lemmings you just bought from Inuit kids herd over the prairies. So they built a turntable, covered it with snow, and spun the lemmings.
Until they were like, yeah,
whoa, and then they fell off the cliff. No, just to get them running.
I see.
Because you can keep a camera on a turntable easier than you can, you know, follow lemmings in a car.
Right.
When the lemmings are just going to sit.
I would think that they would just get a Wolverine or something.
To chase them. They take them to the Bow River in Atlanta, and the sad part is they herd the lemmings over the edge to get the shot they need of lemmings following this compulsion.
Oh, it's not a hysteria. It's a murder.
It's not mass suicide. It's mass murder.
Whoa. They bought these. I bet you they told the Inuit kids, like, "Hey, we'll just borrow your lemmings.
We'll be back in a week. Don't worry, kids."
And then
the kids never saw their pet lemmings again. Right. All those, basically, if you're watching this scene, all those lemmings had names, which is awful, awful to contemplate.
And so you're suggesting that maybe Uncle Walt didn't know about this?
There's no evidence that he knew. You know, it was he had his separate unit shooting these. As I said, you know, a script would be prepared separately. You know, he wasn't really hanging out with biologists at UCLA to find out if the behaviors were all accurate.
Are there instances where Walt Disney used murder to get good performances in other films?
Yeah, all his child actors, their parents all had Lugers to their heads.
Uh-huh.
Walt loved Nazi firearms. When the kids cry in Mary Poppins, it's not because Katie Nan is bad or because Mary Poppins said she's going to leave. They were legit worried.
Walt is right off screen.
You guys know what happens. No, I think this is a very black eye for the Disney company, for Walt Disney Pictures, this moment. And it didn't come out until the 80s, I think.
Oh, that this was true.
Yeah, because I think you have generations of kids assuming that lemmings do this, and a small number of biologists who are like, "No, I don't know. I'm the world's foremost expert in the collared lemming. I've never seen one do this." And gradually, enough of that filters up into the media that the CBC does an expose.
Figures.
And they interview, yeah.
CBC.
State media.
Yeah, trying to get a Canadian Emmy.
Put down a good American entrepreneur like Walter Elias Disney. I bet they weren't claiming he was Canadian anymore.
Yeah, I bet not.
After they found out about his lemming herding. That's when, as early as, I think, 83, there's been media coverage to the effect that actually lemmings don't do this. They've never done this.
It just goes to show, like, how Gary Larson is such a boomer. I don't know how many Far Side cartoons had lemmings in it, but it's, I mean, fewer than...
Well, except for the suicide thing, there's no comic shorthand to lemmings. What are they for, if not...
Right.
there are probably cases where, you know, because they do travel in when they're dispersing, or if you want to say loosely migrating, when they're going to a new area, they do travel in big packs. They're not the brightest.
Right.
There could certainly be cases where they hit a body of water while traveling. The ones in front stop. The ones behind don't. Some lemmings fall in the creek or the lake.
Are they? Can they swim? I mean, rodents can swim.
Lemmings are not strong swimmers.
Oh, well, that's too bad.
So, you know, this is the kind of behavior you could observe and think, these lemmings are dumb as hell. They're, right. They just wanted to migrate so bad, they drowned in the lake.
Some Norwegian could have thought that 500 years ago.
The Norwegians are probably still thinking, oh, they're going to explode. Stand back. This lemming just fell from the sky. Odin threw a lemming at me. Sadly, you know, you've mentioned that lemmings are a linchpin species as food for a lot of mammals of the earth. And sadly, like a lot of Arctic animals, a lot of lemmings are not thriving because they need that insulating layer of snow to have a good breeding season.
Oh, and it's not snowing anymore.
Yeah, you get more thaws and freezes during shoulder seasons, and that's not good for them trying to eat and breed in the winter. And as a result, you know, I was reading an interview with a scientist who studies the lemmings of eastern Greenland because this was Biden era and her funding hadn't been cut yet.
Right, that does seem like one of the things that the funding would get cut.
It is. It turns out we are living in the last year when people will know things.
Right, right. But, you know, like, I'm going to eastern Greenland to study
lemming peaks.
Yeah, it feels like even if I were controlling the grants, I'd be like,
Hopefully Canada is better hearted than you and is still funding some of this. Yeah. Because we have 20 years of good Greenlandic lemming data at this point.
Right.
And we know these peaks are typically 3 to 4 years apart. But in fact, we are now living in a fallow period where it has been 12 years since a lemming peak.
Because
they don't get the climate. Yeah, you're joking around.
Oh, I was.
Meanwhile.
Sad now.
Meanwhile, the lemmings can't score.
Oh.
And so it means foxes and hawks and owls are starting to leave these once lemming-rich lands where they could count on delicious lemming dinners every 3 to 4 years.
This is the circle of life, Ken. Now the foxes and the eagles. What next? I didn't speak up because I wasn't a fox or an eagle.
First, they came for the lemmings,
yeah.
And I didn't speak up. So the lemmings, famous for their dramatic deaths, are actually dramatically dying now. And
but it's not a cinematic death.
Nobody's making documentaries about it.
Well, because, yeah, it's not. There's no glamour in just starving.
We need to arrange. I mean, that is kind of the beauty of nature documentaries today, is they do function as cinematic windows into the need for conservation.
Right.
And so you know, you watch one of these David Attenborough productions knowing the Faustian bargain that you're going to see beautiful things, and then at the end, a very sad 99-year-old British man is going to say, sadly, their numbers are dwindling as habitat loss and hunting cuts down on their populations, you know?
Yeah.
So you get the sad moment at the end and maybe, you know, write a fat check.
Yeah, no, what you do is if you're a millennial, you go on the internet and you yell at people.
Yeah, that's activism.
Ah!
That's activism in a way.
And then close your computer and go, I've done my job today.
Do you dust off your hands
you
like
do,
this?
You do, and you say, too bad, boomers.
Well, not me. I do boomer activism, which is I write a fat check trying to alleviate my generation's guilt.
Yeah, well,
it doesn't work. It doesn't go away.
You have a whole like book of fat checks that, you know.
I do.
I don't.
When you get a TV job, you know how checkbooks are normally like this?
Yeah.
When you get a TV job, they give you one like this.
Because the checks are all twice as fat,
and
right?
You're going to write so many, they know.
Right.
Yeah. So you got to be ready. You got to be prepared for all your good conservation works.
I got the fat passport last time, and then all of my like international touring went away because I became a podcaster.
You have
instead.
A fat, empty passport.
So my passport was like, because the one before that, there wasn't any room for any more stamps. So I was like, oh, I better get a fat one this time. And then it's got like 6 stamps in it. Nothing interesting.
Do they cost more?
I don't know, $20. But whatever it is, it felt like, oh, this is a good investment. And then I felt like a dupe. So I just got a new one. And it is back to being a normal sized.
I'm a fat, empty man. So I think I should have the fat, empty passport. I'm going to request
you should
an upgrade next
time.
Well,
now that you're going to move to England, you should have the fattest passport ever. Do they stamp you when you go over there? Or is it part of some, since Brexit, are they part of some United States of America area?
I think you still get stamped. There's no special relationship where they just let in Americans. Yeah. As long as I stay there less than 6 months out of the year, I think they're happy to welcome me. They do charge you now, I think, 13, you know, I don't know, 12 pounds every 2 years for the extra visa, for the privilege of seeing England. Yeah, we do this too now. We have the ESTA or something where we just gouge tourists.
And so if you go, can you go for 6 months and then go home for a week and then come back for 6 months or no, 6 months
six
a
months,
year?
6 months out of every.
Oh.
I don't know if it's a 12-month period or a calendar year. Probably a calendar year because it's probably got inland revenue connotations.
Right, right, right. Well, anyway, yeah. Back to the lemmings.
Well, there's really not much to say. We all thought they committed suicide, and they don't.
Turns out they just starve.
Yeah, it's not a glamorous ending. I mean, hopefully not. Hopefully the lemmings rebound and thrive.
You know what? I bet you Elon Musk is going to invent snowmaking machines from space that it will
exactly
make it snow all through the Arctic.
You just have to take one of those ski resort machines and shoot it into orbit in a Tesla.
Right.
And then just have it spray snow down on the Earth.
Actually, you know, it's more likely that those ding-dongs will be like, we'll turn it into a tropical resort.
That's right. It'll be the Riviera of Eastern Greenland. Yeah,
the Bering Sea.
Once we get rid of all these lemmings.
And that concludes Lemmings. Entry 711.MK1503. Certificate number 25575 in the omnibus. Futurelings, I don't have to say it. Social media is a big poop.
It's a poop emoji.
And if you are thinking about going on there and yelling at me about saying that millennials don't do anything except tweet, you can just save your energy because you're just pooping in the void. Nobody looks at anybody's tweets anymore. The only ones that anybody sees are the ones that get promoted because they're what? How do you get a tweet promoted?
Twitter is kind of a Potemkin village now, I think, where it's not just that Nobody but MAGA is seeing your tweets. It's, I think, like, just, you know, tombstones are seeing your tweets. Made up people.
Right.
It's like Joseph Kennedy voters are seeing your tweets.
Well, anyway, don't go on there. But if you do want to look for Ken or myself, you just have to Google our names and ignore... Ignore the things about Ken's wife or ignore all the controversies I've ever been in. Just skip past those and go right to the fun stuff, which is basically people praising us.
Or Omnibus Out of Context. That's a fun blue sky account.
Yep. But what you can do is email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can hang out with other futurelings wherever futurelings are sold. You can go to, you know, Facebook, Discord, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can send us real mail at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Sounds like you're opening mail over there. Look at that.
It turns out it's a terrible letter opener. It's also not a very good knife at the moment.
What, the Vietnam-era knife?
Yeah.
Well, I keep it dull just because if I ever have to use it to kill an intruder, I want it to really, like...
You want it to hurt.
I do. I want it to be
I'm sure a thing John that, Rambo kept this knife.
He did.
Here's how good this knife is. I can't open bubble wrap.
Come on. You can, too. Just use your strength. Come on, game show host.
Game show hosts are actually among the fittest of...
Of our species?
Of our species, yeah. Like, that's why I'm having 15 kids from a series of sperm donations. Mm-hmm. Todd was recently in Goodland, Kansas, as proven by this Goodland, Kansas postcard. And he wants us to know about the 1910 Kansas flying machine, a weird helicopter-like thing.
Named after Kansas.
The state of its origin. There are only two existing photographs of this thing, but there's a replica in the Goodland Museum today where you can push a button and make the propellers spin. According to the museum, it was the first patented helicopter in the U.S., but it never flew, possibly because it wouldn't have. I don't know. but here's a book you can get in a self-published 1982 book you can get in the museum there called The Short Happy Life of the Kansas Flying Machine. And I love this. It was printed and bound by the visual communications classes at Goodland High School in 1982.
All right.
Some high school teacher made sure this got made. You can see the blueprints for this possibly non-viable helicopter.
It looks very much like it was cribbed from Leonardo da Vinci.
Yeah. Kansas was, as they are in all things, roughly 400 years behind Florence.
I have never been to Goodland, Kansas, nor have I ever heard of Goodland,
I don't know.
Kansas.
What do you think it's close to?
I mean, I don't know. Oakley, Kansas? What is anything in Kansas close to?
Some of it's close to Colorado.
Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come.
Oh, I guess this isn't really for Omnibus. Sam Keen also sent us a galley of his new book, Dinner with King Tut. He's a popular science writer. I really liked his book, The Disappearing Spoon. This one's about how rogue archaeologists are recreating the sights, smells, and tastes of lost civilizations.
I don't know if I want any of those things.
You don't want to know what Egyptian milkshakes tasted like?
No, or what Egyptian, like, cafeterias smelled like. Like, I feel like we have improved. I don't know if right now we have improved, but I think somewhere in the 1920s, maybe. When do you think the peak of cuisine was?
Oh, I think we're still...
You think we're on our way still?
I think
still?
We're still coming up on it.
Still going up?
You look at fancy menus in the 1920s and it's like iceberg steak. Lettuce salad, followed by lamb chops.
I know, but that sounds great to me.
I'm not saying this is bad food. I'm just saying it's probably not peak cuisine because nobody's ever had a curry.
Oh, that's true.
Or right. Quesadilla.
I mean, some people had had a curry, just not anybody in Paris.
It's true. I should not say. I just mean the people writing the cuisine magazines did not know, like... hundreds of good foods.
Right, that's true. There wasn't any Thai food in Seattle at that point. Well, and the last thing I want to say to everyone is that we really appreciate those of you who are contributing to our Patreon at patreon.com/omnibusproject. You are the...
There would be no omnibus right now without you.
Yeah, you are the
wind beneath our wings.
Thank you. I'm struggling to remember exactly what it was beneath our wings.
As a huge Bette Midler fan, I was offended.
But I really, really want to thank those of you who are giving to the show. And I want to encourage those of you who are on the fence about it or who used to donate to the show and have kind of fallen off for whatever reason, changed your credit card or hit hard times as the stock market cratered, and think seriously about, even as your stock wealth has withered, that maybe your money is well spent supporting the Omnibus Project.
You could have put it in Tesla and you didn't. Well, maybe some
shouldn't
of you
have done that
maybe
either.
Some of you did. Sorry,
shouldn't have done that.
But yeah, if
should have bought quesadillas.
Yeah, I mean quesadillas are always a good buy.
Yeah,
they're a good value often for like the size, for the footprint of the food you get. Nothing's more acreage per dollar than the delicious quesadilla.
And it's a good way, as we know, a good way to store wealth in quesadillas.
That's exactly right. Insulate your home with quesadillas, chicken quesadillas. Maybe carnitas,
quesadillas,
red cashew nut, white cashew nut,
mm-hmm. Walnut.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.